This is an emergency transmission from TV Cream.
Hello, I'm Jack and this is TV Cream Stays Indoors. In this podcast, I send someone a link to an old TV show and then once they've watched it, I call them up to find out what they've made of it. Today, I'm talking to Rose Rain, who's safely inside somewhere in Glasgow.
Can I come in?
Rose, the video link I sent you was for Dave Allen in Search of the Great English Eccentric, which was first shown on ITV on the 8th of October 1974. Before you'd even watched the show, what was your reaction to that choice?
My reaction was definitely delight, because it's quite an influential documentary on me and my sensibilities, and a bit of a favourite. But I was also really curious because I hadn't seen it for quite a long time, and I think I was very aware that in the intervening years, there was probably bits of it that I expected I'd think differently about.
For those who might not have watched this programme, can you just talk us through what it is?
Yeah, so in some ways it's quite a conventional documentary in that it involves Dave Allen going around and visiting with a number of people who are eccentric in some way. But I think it's unconventional in the sense of the structure, the weave of it is quite loose, and there's a couple of passages of sort of silent observation. It visits with these people. It gives you insights into their situations and their thought processes and their enjoyment of the things they do and the way that they interact with the world. And, you know, you with some of them, you see them meeting other people. But not only does it not have a voiceover, but it's not making a case. It doesn't have a thesis. It doesn't pontificate.
Yeah. So over the course of the documentary, obviously we meet a number of eccentrics.
Good morning. I wonder, could you tell me, please, where Mr. Alexander Whartley lives, please?
And the first one we get to know properly is this chap called Alexander Stewart Whartley, who lives in a tiny railway box.
Alexander? Oh, yes. His house is round the back. You can go either way, actually.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Not at all.
So Whartley, he appears to live in someone else's back garden. And Dave Allen pointedly asks the owner what her children think of him. And although she says they love him, she also adds that one or two of the neighbours find him uncomfortable. Now, if this documentary was made today, wouldn't that be the main focus?
Oh, yeah, definitely. He is a very eccentric older man with unfettered access to children, which is no, you know, I'm not casting aspersions on him at all, but those are moments that you get when you watch older programming where naturally we're sort of agog at some sort of, well, at any, you know, not just men, but, you know, especially men, but any stranger having unfettered access to children. But yeah, there's definitely things where you get like quite a vertiginous, dizzying sense of the difference in the values then and now.
One or two find him uncomfortable. And that's usually, you know, because they can't put up with eccentricity in any way. They're much too conformist.
Yeah, what that lady says about the neighbours.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of can't imagine neighbours tolerating that. In the simplest terms, it feels like something that just wouldn't happen there.
Yes, it was built by reels, some of this stuff.
Yeah.
Real, it's a real box. Yours is more or less a phantom box, you see, but this is a real one.
What I do find incredibly admirable about this whole documentary is it does not feel like you are meant to laugh at those people, and it doesn't, it's very much not a "or the state of you" documentary. It's not the nick of these people. It feels warm and respectful.
So intercut throughout the film is an interview with this chap who's he's a former robot maker for TV who pretends to fly Lancaster bombers. Now, one of the early excerpts with him, he says,
I'm in a strange world of illusion and fantasy and reality that it's a marvellous world to be in.
Do you think this programme is inviting us to agree with him?
So I think he's a bit of an outlier in this compared to the other participants in two ways. I got the impression he probably might have gone to art school or been involved in the arts in some way, because he does talk about being a TV prop maker. And so there is like a slight postmodernness to some of what he does. So he's slightly different to the other participants in that way. But I also think that he's a bit of an outlier in that I don't think it necessarily invites you to agree that he lives in a wonderful, fantastical world, because I think there is a pall of kind of melancholy that hangs over him. And again, you know, it sort of calls attention to the very restrained and compassionate way in which this documentary is made, and the fact that it, you never have a sense of it sort of agenda or arguments closing round either the people on camera or around you watching. And I definitely think that you slash, or certainly I did watching that, that there's a real kind of quite a stereotypical Peter Pan complex with him, because he talks about like wanting to be a pop star in that kind of heart-breaking, like vaguely deluded, where immediately you get a bit of a winky bum and you're like, oh, fuck, mate, no, that's not going to happen.
Well, this year is going to be my great dream. I'm going to be a pop star. I'm going to be on Top of the Pops with Jill, my wife, with her own number, you know. But shall I play you a little bit of... And I've got a rhythm machine here, look.
Well, we'll get back to him, because of all the people who we meet in this documentary, he was the one who I felt most worried about. So I think we're going to circle back around him a few times through this discussion. So I now want to move on to this chap called Edward Blackmore, who with his wife lives as, to use the language of the programme, a Red Indian. So here's my question. What is the role of women in this documentary?
I don't really feel like I could talk about the role of women before I paused for a moment to acknowledge that this is probably the trickiest one in terms of the different values we have now compared to the values of the 70s.
Of course, the Indians generally offered a prayer when they...
Did the women get a smoke?
No.
Blackmore refers to his mode of attire and his interest as Red Indians, which is not a thing we would say now.
Yes.
We call them First Nation peoples or Indigenous people or Native Americans. But what I would say about Edward Blackmore is he's incredibly educated and respectful about the traditions of the First Nation peoples or the Native Americans, and he actually has gone and spent time with them and been given his own name by them.
What about his missus though? Now she's also dressed.
So she is
that.
Dressed.
So is she willing? What, you know, what's your take on this? And what do you think of the women in this documentary? Or how this documentary treats women?
Well, it's tricky. Everyone's there as a wife. The women are outside the outsiders.
Is she?
They don't ever speak to her really or ask her particularly what she thinks. Mm-hmm. And although she has sort of hitched her life to Edward's and seems, I assume, to enjoy what is a shared interest, it appears to have been his interest that she has stepped into.
And Mrs. Blackmore, when did you become interested in Indians?
Well, when I met my husband.
You never find out was she equally interested in the first place. She's very much there as his spouse. She's very much there as an appendage. Mm. And she's not asked what she thinks in the same way that in the later part, the man with the railway layout, whose wife, again, is in costume in the way that Edward Blackmore's wife is and appears to be intimately involved and enmeshed in the practice of this interest. Nobody speaks to them. You know, and here's something. So I find myself naturally assuming, I think in a way that feels quite 70s. It probably feels like a result of having grown up with that dynamic in television and stuff. I do sort of assume that those women have taken on the husband's interest.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be in their life regardless.
Yeah.
And I find myself not assuming that they bonded over a shared interest in these things, but assuming that it's in their life, they might as well, you know.
Yeah.
If you can't beat them, join them, and that's not necessarily correct, but what it does call attention to is the fact that nobody thinks to ask them.
Mr. Blackmore, this is not what one would really expect to find in a place like Eastbourne.
Is he good, Dave Allen, at this?
I think he's really good. Because he does just go and visit with them. Mm. And although he sort of does give like sort of little smiles and not quite winks, but little looks of complicity to the camera, out to the audience that say, yeah, right, I know this is quite challenging, but it never feels like he's laughing at the participants. So we're very acclimatised to, particularly someone like Louis Theroux, going and talking to people.
Did you come? I like you being on top. Why have you highlighted, I like the rear entry position?
And he is sort of always trying not just to get to the heart of the why.
Yeah.
What made you like this? You know, what a trauma in your life, or, you know, what aspect of your psychology made you think this was a good idea, or attracted you to this lifestyle or this aesthetic or this political choice or psychological state. So Dave Allen doesn't really ask that. He's never really saying to them, aren't you worried people will think you're mental?
Yeah, yeah.
Aren't you worried people will think you are strange? There's something more compassionate. It feels open-minded, even though occasionally there is a definite feeling of sort of smirking.
Yeah. So now we come on Snowy Farr, who to me, I think, is probably the most unfathomable of all the people in it. So who is this guy?
Snowy Farr raised over the years like thousands and thousands of pounds
for
charity.
So he was well known in...
He was well known in Cambridge, in Cambridge.
Okay.
Sure. He made all these like very complicated sort of bicycle and trailer contraptions that, according to your taste, to me and to a lot of people, they're very beautiful.
Yeah.
They're a sort of combination of fairground and gypsy caravan and that sort of aesthetic. And and then sort of almost lay preacher, because they've got sort of slogans on them. And he's dressed as a sort of Crimean soldier. I mean, he definitely looks like he's walked out of the television of our childhood and the cinema of our childhood. You know, he's sort of got those 60s does Victoriana vibe. So he's dressed in kind of pseudo military garb with like a great big white beard and a top hat. You know, so the most like the man off the Quality Street.
Yes, that's who he is. Yeah. But what did he used to do then? So he used to, just correct me if I'm wrong here, he would go to things like fates and all that sort of stuff with all his contraptions.
Yeah, with all his contraptions, dressed up in all his gears, now here's another thing where you're like, oh, you wouldn't get it now.
Yeah.
He, under his hat and down his jacket, full of kittens, chicks, mice, live animals.
Now bring your mice to Snowy. Oh, bring your mice to Snowy, one at a time.
But he's the sort of epitome of, do you want to see some puppy dogs sort of thing? That's what you get in terms of the suspicion that people today would apply to someone.
No,
like
totally
that.
And he automatically speaks of that suspicion that we'd have now. I know this sounds terribly reductive, but he appears to have been like quite childlike in his way. He also, in a different way to the Lancaster Bomberman, seems sort of childlike and straight. He too seems not to have grown up.
And what we're talking about here is not casting aspersions on him. What we're saying is that this form of eccentricity is something that would not be allowed to exist today, because people would be suspicious.
Yeah, absolutely. And
these sorts of motivations.
You know, not only is it like all those stories that start with a stranger comes to town.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. But, you know, I think he's a childless single man going round to village greens saying, come on, come on, come little children, look at my puppies. Mm-hmm. It absolutely conforms to our stereotype of stranger danger. This is something I've talked to a lot of people about, the strangeness of, for example, where my grandma lived when I was a kid. There was a proper creepy man that hung about in the park and offered children money And there was no sense of calling the police. Like, there was a real sense of, like, oh, don't go near him, don't take his money.
Mm-hmm. Now, I found Snowy kind of unfathomable. Can you get your head around why he lived in the way that he lived or not?
I look at someone like him and there's ways in which you feel impossible not to think that a life so completely diverted towards sort of doing good.
Yeah.
And being so involved with, like, the gentle, happy, uncomplicated things of the world is trying to defy something sad. But, you know, that they're turning their back entirely on one set of things, and in order to face entirely towards something else is not necessarily a way that most adults live.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I find it impossible not to look at someone like that and feel like maybe there is some, you know, surely there's something that motivates you to be so sort of monomaniacally ploughing all your efforts into one thing.
Mm.
If you could change the world, Snowy,
that'd be a problem.
What would you do?
Would I do? Mm. Oh dear, I shouldn't have so many cars on the road. I'd never feel more than these old carts.
The other thing that, just as we're talking about this, that occurs to me is back in the 1970s, not only did we not necessarily think we could understand the psychology of that and the pathology of that, but actually we weren't actually necessarily that interested. And it was just enough to say, oh, they're just an eccentric. We didn't have to have the key to unlock their psyche. Do you think that's true?
I think that's true. And I think there is a very tricky thing there about what you gain and what you lose, because I think what's lovely about this documentary is it doesn't treat any of those people as problems to be solved, and it doesn't try and pathologize any of those people. And I think we do overrush sometimes to pathologize people.
Do you basically think that man is going wrong somewhere?
Wrong? They all go wrong. They are in my little offense, you see. Yeah. Oh, they got no manliness about them today, I don't think. They go gadding about, they want to be here, there and everywhere, you see. I mean, they couldn't walk, they're young, fit chaps, you know. That won't keep them fit riding about. Walk and pedal this lot up Castle Hill, that'd do them, wouldn't it? Oh, they couldn't do it, they can't even shove an ordinary bike. Oh dear, it's wonderful.
Right, so we come back to the Lancaster Bomberman again, and it's at this point where we are introduced to this robot he's created.
But,
has she got a name?
Yes, she's called...
Monambo!
Oh, that's not what her name is, no. No, her name is called Rosa Bosom.
So, first of all, can you just describe Rosa Bosom? And then, tell me what you made of her.
Rosa, I slightly struggled with Rosa Bosom in that, like, so on one hand, Rosa Bosom's very recognisable to me as the stuff that I really loved growing up. You know, that kind of aesthetic that was on children's TV a lot. All that kind of, like, slightly scary, like, homemade science with a great egg race. Rosa Bosom feels like she's really of that world.
Right.
But the thing is, so Bomberman's attitude to Rosa Bosom... I wasn't keen on.
Right.
He's made a woman to control. He's made a sexy lady robot to control that will say what he wants her to say and flirt with him as he wants to be flirted with.
She's capable of giving you a kiss, you see. There you are.
Oh.
Yeah, but, yeah. And her arms go up and down. And, her mouth opens and closes, as you can see, and also her heart. That's right, yes, because she falls in love.
However, Rosa Bosom is way more of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, Roger Ruskin, Spear Robot world, where she's like a big sort of set of kissy, lipsticky, Salvador Dali lips on, like, what sort of looks like a filing cabinet or wheels. She's actually, you know, so she's got all the hallmarks of a sex robot. Basically, but she's a clunky heap of junk, and she sort of trundles round going,
she needs adjusting.
But she also is ridiculous.
Hmm.
And she's shit.
She is shit.
Like, she's very shit.
Yeah. Ivor Cutler is next.
I think very deeply.
dogs. Now, I thought it was a bit incongruous to see Ivor Cutler in this. First of all, he's not English. And secondly, he was already quite well known. So he had a record contract with Virgin at this point. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, he's a complete and utter outlier to the documentary because he's arch and knowing. So he's got a record contract. He's already got a fandom at that point. And although Dave Allen is very warm and engaged and interested with all the other participants, with Ivor Cutler it comes across as like a collegiate thing. It's definitely different when he's with him, that it feels like fellow performers. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like those glimpses into lives otherwise unseen.
Mm. So there is a bit, yes, and I thought it was quite an important bit. Now, when Ivor's singing about an old oak tree and he starts laughing, and then so does Dave.
An old oak tree, a long girl stands with her back on the bark and her arms are limp. Her arms are limp because her bra's too tight and the blood can not get through.
But it feels like they're both laughing together at the joke. And so I suppose the thing that the question it raises in my mind is, because Ivor Cutler's commercialised his eccentricity, does that mean he is eccentric or not?
You know, I don't feel the need to square their circle.
Okay.
But there are definitions of eccentricity that disallow for the eccentricity to be in any way knowing or performed or contrived.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cleave to that definition of eccentricity, Ivor Cutler's not.
Okay.
And eccentric in that way.
Breaking news.
Yeah, the thing is with someone like Ivor Cutler is that we still have those figures of people who are the safe kind of eccentric.
Mm.
Because part of what we like about it is the knowingness and the performance. We're still not really any good when we suspect that someone might actually be touched with madness.
Yes.
Or that their eccentricity might be the result of trauma or sadness or things that we find harder to deal with. So people like Ivor Cutler are, in a way, our favourite kinds of eccentrics, because we don't have to worry about whether or not we're laughing at them.
Yes.
Or being interested in them in some kind of morally dubious way.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I do think that involves being male, because still when you get female artists or female eccentrics, I think a woman being eccentric automatically invokes the spectre of madness.
Mm-hmm.
And thus we still have quite a different attitude.
Okay, so... So Ivor Cutler is an eccentric who we don't have to worry about.
Yeah.
And then we go back to our pal, the Lancaster Bomberman, who is an eccentric that I worried about while watching this documentary. And of all the eccentrics who we see, I think we agree, don't we, that he felt the unhappiest.
There's some sense of the mother, isn't there? Dwelling on the mum and still having the mum's thing and having all his things from childhood.
Well, I like to collect things that people have used. There again, because they're steeped in humanity.
He talks about these very clearly failed and failing pop star aspirations and that he's made this kind of electronic voice instrument that even when he sort of tries to make it function for the purposes of the camera, it fails. And this is the point at which you most, I think, and maybe the only point where you see Dave Allen slightly feel like he might be laughing a bit at him.
Yes.
Because all the other people in this are succeeding at what they want to do. You have a sense that they're having a good time, that this is a lifestyle choice or a hobby or an interest, that their sort of deep and complete buy-in is working.
Mm-hmm.
For them.
He does say quite clearly in the documentary that he's happy. He talks about this wonderful imaginary world.
It just doesn't ring true, though, does it? I feel like you can see that Dave Allen doesn't either.
Mm.
Well, not, first of all, none of the other participants feel the need, in the way that people who are doing all right don't feel the need to tell you how great things are.
Mm.
And none of the other people in the documentary tell you how great this is. They don't have that questionable evangelical zeal for the thing they... They're just delighted to talk about it.
Mm.
There's something a bit shrill and manic
about
the Lancaster Bomberman. It all feels like a carapace. It feels a bit brittle.
Mm.
It's impossible not to feel like, or I feel like it's impossible to not feel like it's all motivated by something altogether bleaker and sadder, and that the presence of all this stuff, both in the way he talks about it and the actual stuff he's doing and making and the stuff he's kept from his childhood and his mum and things, the presence of all that stuff feels very much like it's compensating for the lack of something else.
Bless him. So thankfully we move on then to the final eccentric who we meet in this documentary, and I felt that we were in psychologically far safer ground. So this is a chap called Victor Martin.
Good morning. Can I come in?
Yes, come in.
Who has a very wonderful and intricate model railway that and he runs a service on this model railway, doesn't he? And and actually the intricacy of his setup is something that struck me as something that seems to be important to an eccentric. And and although some of them in this program live what seems to be a simple life, none of them live a sparse life. So it is intricacy important to eccentricity?
Yeah, because it's usually about abundance. We don't view extreme minimalism as an eccentricity. It both gets taken as an indicator of good taste and actually as like some kind of morally superior way of life. I think most eccentricity usually involves like a total absorption and a total commitment to an idea, and all, whether it, you know, whether it's a hobby or whatever interest it is, all these things have an aesthetic of some kind. It's always abundant.
At one point, Victor says his railway has given him 14 years of
great joy and happiness, you know.
And to me, that's in part because he's been able to live another life and sort of look back to another time. And is that what this documentary says that eccentrics do? Are all eccentrics, according to this documentary, nostalgic?
I think all eccentrics live intensely in our present that they are creating, and that it's not uncommon for that to be involved in something nostalgic and of the past, especially with things like model villages and model railway layouts. It's very rare that, or it's reasonably rare, that people are making modern environments, in that it's usually, you know, so some people are very hung up on the detail of it being historically accurate to the time period of their railway. And then some people, it's about that sort of, that it's more about the feeling quality of like a happy, uncomplicated past. That sort of, that village green feeling, that it could be a quiet sunny day now, or it could be between the wars, or, you know, it's sort of nebulously retro. The way that nostalgia works is we're usually nostalgic for something that hovers on the edge of our memory. It's usually something from a generation slightly before. So, you know, a lot of people our age collect mid-century modernism now.
Did this documentary move you?
Yeah, it did. It moved me in a couple of different ways. Some of the people, particularly the Mammoth Model Railway layout, those people seem so happy. We're so often looking for that particular kind of happiness, aren't we, where it's a way of spending time without noticing time passing, because it's a thing that completely absorbs you, that you enjoy so much. And there's something very moving about seeing people practice an interest that is so nourishing to them in an uncomplicated way, and where, you know, it fills their days and their time. Also made me in a kind of complicated way because of the gender politics thing. I guess it slightly moved me to anger when I do think about, like, a woman pursuing a singular vision usually gets called crazy. It's not as acceptable. And so that sort of moved me to anger and made me feel very sad, because I don't feel like that's very different now.
So, how did Dave Allen in Search of the Great English Eccentric fit into your day? Did it cheer you up seeing it again?
So, I don't always want to watch things in lockdown. I find that my concentration's quite short. Like, I have slightly tended towards watching and reading things in snack-sized bites. Like, I'm really struggling to read novels. I'm reading short stories and essays a lot at the moment. But part of what I enjoyed about watching this was feeling completely absorbed back into it really quickly, and the sort of certainty that had I not seen it before, it would have gripped me in that way straight away. So that was quite nice. It was quite nice to feel like I had to sit down and watch something, because I think, you know, part of navigating the lockdown is sort of being, you have to live in short futures, and sometimes you can't even afford to create the smallest expectation on yourself, because then it just creates a sense of failure, because everything's quite amplified by the situation. So sometimes at the moment, if I feel like I have to do something, it feels quite nice.
And how are you finding life in lockdown?
Quite hard. I miss all the things everybody else misses. I miss my friends and my family, and I'm pretty prone to depression. And I think sitting about in the house all day is, to me, absolutely redolent of being depressed. And I think there's like an accidental fake it till you make it thing, where like I'm living in a situation that reminds me of being depressed. So I keep, I think, accidentally assuming that I'm depressed and getting depressed because of it. That's far from ideal, but then bits of it are really nice, and I'm very, very glad that I like cooking, because I get a lot of pleasure out of that. I've got very nice friends, and we all check in on one another, and I also realize I'm very fortunate, because I've got a lot of hobbies like drawing and reading and cooking, so, you know, none too shabby. Bit sad.
The end of the song.
Thank you, Rose, for watching Dave Allen in Search of the Great English Eccentric, and thank you for talking to me about it.
Now, stay indoors.